Well, Carlton, we're actually here because we both attended the funeral of our friend Steve Ripley. And you spoke so eloquently at that service. You opened and closed it. Shows how close you were to the family. They selected you to do that. Yes. At the end of the service, we talked about then recording your story. So that's how we connected, even though we'd known each other in the community. It's one of those moments and one of those coincidences that bring us to this point. Mm-hmm. And Steve, of course, was so talented, recording artist, record producer, songwriter, studio engineer, guitarist, inventor. And then he was a leader and producer of the country rock band, The Tractors. When I interviewed him for the third time, he said, "What I'm about to say, I do not want to be on the website until after I die." Unfortunately, he died January 3rd, 2019, and he talked about you in that segment, and you've listened to that segment and heard what he said. But that's, you talk about him. You interacted with him. You did music. You recorded. Kind of talk about him and your relationship.
Well, he was one of the easiest. We recorded for 25 years, and I wasn't always in the studio with the engineers and what have you, because a lot of that was done in Nashville. But with Church Studios, which he owned, we were happy to find that because it saved us a lot of money. And then he was instantly one of us. He had no arrogance, not even any austerity about him. He was just very rustic and earthy. And when they introduced me to him, they didn't introduce me to him as the owner. They said he's the engineer. And he didn't act like the owner. He looked like a hired hand, acted like a hired hand. He was crawling around on the floors, repairing and fixing and plugging things up and down and running across there. But I knew that he owned the place in his consciousness. It was his baby. My album became his baby, our production. He would come into and give me hints or instructions or sometimes criticisms because I've had to redo something on what I did. And for some reason, I thought, who's this white dude telling me how to do my kind of singing? And he was right. Everything he said, he didn't sing our kind of music. He loved it. But when he said, do it this way, do it again, you got another one in you, I instantly believed him. We didn't talk a lot about our kind of, and I loved him. There was something about him that was very pastoral. As I said at the funeral, he cared for all of us. I took my kids down there. They were infants when we would record. He was always grinning at them, make sure that they were comfortable if they needed anything and baby stuff. He's really into babies, and I just connected with him almost instantly.
Yeah, and he was born into the Baptist church, so his faith of the gospel that spreads to many denominations was the same as yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he fully understood what you were, and did you feel that connection from him?
I did. I felt like he was a believer. He wasn't super religious at all, but you knew that he was spiritual, almost mystical. Yeah. He had a connection with the earth and dust. I mean, tractors, red earth, red necks, red country. He was a really rugged guy. But I didn't feel any hints of racism in him at all. No. He was just a cultural Oklahoman. He loved Oklahoma and loved Oklahomans. And he totally disarmed us. Never alarmed us. We felt he could fix anything, and he did. From an organ, a Hammond B3, which he loved, to some piece of equipment. He had all this stuff in there. And he was running around. I don't remember seeing a bunch of crew with him. It seems he was doing a lot of it himself. And David said, "Pastor, you can trust him. You can trust him." So I did.
Yeah. Well, he talked about his brothers being mechanical, and he wasn't in the sense that they were, like they could fix a car, but he said, "I realized I was mechanical," and what you just...
With technology.
And then he created... invented new use of the guitar,
yes.
Made guitars and all that kind of thing. So yeah. I only knew him for a short time. I wish I'd known him longer, but he likes to talk about it was a crack in the cosmos.
Yeah.
And Dylan fell down and Leon fell down. Well, Steve Ripley fell down
cosmos
as well.
I do too. I think the same thing.
Special man.
Yeah. His last text to me was about, I had it on my phone. He saw my daughter sing on The Four, and he'd been watching that, and he congratulated me on that because he'd remembered her almost in diapers. literally just crawling around the floor there in the studio. And he saw the movie and was very eager to discuss it. I was on my way out. We had planned that I should go out to the farm and just sit with him, and we were just going to talk theology, because he agreed with my expansive, radically inclusive theology and made that very clear to me. And when the shift took place, he was one of the few people with whom we had worked who did not change his attitude, professional people, who did not change his attitude toward us at all. In fact, the last CD we recorded, David mixed it down there with him, and the record companies would not even release it.
Because?
Because of inclusion. The radio stations, we released a couple songs, they played them singles, and it went nuts. The people started calling, asking for the album, and then when the record company sent the albums, the CDs, to the bookstores wouldn't even open the boxes, the Christian bookstores, sent them all back, and that album has only recently been released. I do not know by whom. I offered him thousands of dollars to let us buy it back, because it was songs that our people had written, a lot of original songs. David, who went $50,000 over budget producing it, I let him do it because it was his first soul album that he could produce, and it was just the most anointed, that's the term we use, of all the ones all the several ones, including the ones we got Stellar Awards for and Dove nominations for. So it's really heartbreaking.
I stumbled into another blowback that you had from the inclusion story.
Yeah.
Your records weren't even played. They were sent back
And
not even sold.
And all my books and CDs were taken off the bookshelves of the Christian bookstores here in Tulsa. And that was very hurtful.
Yeah.
But some one of the times, incidentally, when I was wrestling with cancer, one of the times, this is a story that I'll never forget, and I've told it publicly a few times, I was very angry at fundamentalists not because they rejected my message, but because they rejected me as a human being and my people as human beings. And it was the time I just returned from Ghana. I'd had a pretty violent reaction over there with bleeding and all that stuff. And embarrassing. And I came back home to get it correct. Some of it, they did some work when I was in Ghana. I spent the whole night in the hospital there, but I had to come back here and get some other work. And I remember when I went into my urologist's office, it wasn't my normal urologist, it was another guy. And he was very kind, and the lady was kind. And they were going to recatheterize me or something like that. And that was always embarrassing to me. And the lady said, "What, would you like me to put some music on for you? Christian music," because she knew I was a preacher. Christian music? Not necessarily. I'm going to be mad at Christians for a while because they've stopped playing my music in this city on a Christian radio station. So I'm laying there. I went through this pretty humiliating treatment. They finish a walk, and I'm laying there naked on this table with my face toward the west wall. There was a wall there, and it was probably one of the lowest times in that whole few years period I went with treatment of cancer. And I said, "You're probably done with me, God. This is humiliating. I'm angry. I'm alone. This is pretty much probably it. I'm not going to deal with this the rest of my life." And the radio station was still tuned to this Christian station. And one of my songs that I recorded, I'm in the room by myself. The doctor's gone. The nurse is gone. They said, "Clean yourself up and come out. We'll see." And my song, "I'm working on a building. It's a shoe foundation. I'm holding up the bloodstain banner." I couldn't believe it. My song came on. And it was that song. Boy, you got stuff to do. You're working on a building. It's a sure foundation. You got a life to live. I mean, that moment was most transformative of all the moments of the whole experience. And I had an attitude toward the nurse, I had an attitude toward the Christian station, I had an attitude toward God and me, and that one song which I recorded, which wasn't one of the hit songs on the album, just changed my life. I think I recorded that song for me, for that moment, and maybe nobody else on the planet.
Well, that moment is about as big as your epiphany moment.
Yes.
Because then you knew that there's God, something for me to do.
Yes.
And he wants me to stay alive.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, we stumbled onto a good story there.
Uh-huh.
But Steve talks about the choirs coming into church studio and everybody getting around and singing around the Steinway. That must have been a great experience.
With that choir, our church choir, well, that was mostly our church choir. The Azusa Choir was a combination of all the voices that came in from around the country and a lot of our other choirs here, local choirs in Tulsa, because that choir would be 200 voices. But the 20 or 30 that we consistently had for the recording to make it, to clean up all the recording, those kids were really covenantly connected. And they would worship for 30 minutes or an hour. And Steve, we're paying for the hours. He never charged us for over... staying overtime. He never put pressure on us. I mean, he could tell when the energy shifted and they weren't going to rehearse or just, I mean, they started worshiping and ministering to each other and crying and, you know, and getting happy, what we call getting happy and quick. But he just watched them do it.
And he didn't charge you.
And he did not charge us because he knew it was a shift in the spiritual energy. That's the kind of man he was.
Yeah. You're a survivor now of your cancer.
Yes, sir. I'm cancer-free.
That's great to hear. Did you ever have contact with the Gaithers, Bill and Gloria Gaither, at all?
Oh, yes. I've been to their home. I love them. Every time they came to Tulsa, I was there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I love the Gaithers.
They should have, I don't know if they ever thought about including you at some time, bringing you up on stage and singing, or did you ever do any of that?
Well, he invited me and Carmen. Carmen never did go, and I would have gone with, if Carmen had have gone. Carmen was a gospel singer in my church. I'm not sure why. It was never an official thing with contracts and all, but I would have done it. He always referred to me from the stage, and I loved Vestal Goodman, who I had tried to get. One of my major regrets in my recording of the Azusa music was I never got Vestal. And I want her to sing Peace in the Valley with me, another wonderful singer. Mickey Mangan sang it with me, but I wanted an old white Pentecostal, like, Vestal that had that guts, that chutzpah, that was just powerful. Yeah. She sang at John Osteen's funeral. He loved her. And I remember how the whole crowd was moved when she sang for him. But anyway, whenever they came, Jesse Dixon was a good friend of mine. So I would always sing with him. And we'd, in between the breaks, we'd hang out and talk. And then, of course, I went to his house. We'd sit for hours and just listening to
– To Bill's house?
To Bill's house in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I love the Gaithers. To this day, we're very, very friends. And he's never rejected me or the message.
Oh, that's right. The inclusion.
Right.
He could have.
Yes. Third Church of God, Anderson, the non-Pentecostal. There's a Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee. There are Pentecostals. So I didn't know. But he's been around Pentecostals all his life and loves black singers and black. He has records, vinyl records, a treasure trove of them in his home of Doris Akers and Ethel Waters or anybody that sang gospel 50 to 100 years ago almost. He's collected all that stuff. And he knows all these people personally. Andre Crouch, Lily Knowles, she's 82 years old. She called me just last week. She was on all his family, the Gaither reunion tapes. She's the heavyset black girl with the always wore hat. I say girl, she's 82 literally. In fact, I called her Mother Knowles on the phone. She said, "Don't you dare call me. I'm Lily Knowles." But a delightful, delightful lady.
Yeah, and so since the inclusion, you've had interaction with Bill and been to his house? And then,
yeah, not since inclusion. But that was before inclusion, but he's been here two or three times since.
And didn't treat you differently?
Not at all.
Welcomed you and all
acknowledges me from the stage. If I'm in the audience, yeah. And then during the breaks, I go back into his dressing room, and we talk and chatted and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, we've treasured many concerts by the Gaithers, that's for sure. Well, all this part came up as we were talking about our friend Steve Ripley.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah.